very hierarchical animal.
Yeah.
You know how a hierarchy works in a chicken yard. You see peace, nobody's pecking on anybody else except the bottom chicken who gets pecked on occasionally. And the peace is there because the top chicken is utterly in the command and leadership position. She has established that position by taking on every other chicken in the yard at one point or another and demonstrating that she's their superior. That is called a dominance hierarchy, a pecking order. And we humans are really hierarchical animals. So we are constantly struggling for top position or the highest position we can get. And that's not only true of individual humans competing against each other, it's true of groups of humans, and it's true of nations. Nations, tribes, and civilizations. And right now, normally, the way a country competes with other countries is by demonstrating it can gather more surplus than anybody else, that it can produce more than anybody else, and it can have the cutting edge technologically over anybody else.
What if, despite what you've been told, the natural world isn't sacred, but savage? And what if it's your job to outcreate it? Well, as you consider that, I'm about to introduce you to someone who will challenge everything you've been told about nature, energy, sex, and the universe. Just a small subject matter. This will be a wildly irreverent, I know that for sure, deeply brilliant, and in all likelihood, sometimes a good laugh out loud conversation. I know this because the next two episodes, I'm sitting down with my mate, Howard Bloom. The man has been called the Einstein of consciousness and a scientific shaman of the modern age. He's written many best-selling books, had documentaries made about him, and he's been featured on some of the biggest media outlets on the planet, including the Joe Rogan Experience. Welcome to the Dov Barron Show. Come for the stories, stay for the learning. I'm your host, Dov Barron. I advise high-performing leaders and organizations in how to harness their emotional source code to purposefully transform their tribe. Today on the Dov Barron Show, a MacArthur-level thinker who spent decades tearing apart dogma in science, culture, and politics, Howard Bloom. His new book is The Case of the Sexual Cosmos. It isn't just provocative, it's a declaration of war on the second law of thermodynamics, eco-fundamentalism, and the spiritual emptiness of modern science. Now, if that sounds outrageous, good. I think it's meant to be. More on that in a moment. You're tuned into the Dov Barron Show. This isn't just another podcast. It's an exploration into the minds that shape the world. Every episode is a raw, unscripted collaboration between my guests and me as we dive into the truths that few dare to ask. We find guests for you who are often unknown to the public, but genuine titans in their field, the kinds of people that high-profile leaders turn to when they need an edge. If you're the kind of leader who craves depth over sound bites, hit that subscribe button right now, because this is where real thinkers come to sharpen their edge. For the next two episodes, this isn't just a conversation, it's an intellectual adventure, one that will span quantum consciousness, the roles of oxytocin in leadership, and how AI is rewiring research itself. If you're tired of simplistic takes, smug consensus, and the tyranny of binary thinking, welcome home. Please turn up the volume and help me to welcome returning champion, my mate, Howard Bloom. Welcome, Howard.
Dov, it's wonderful to see you.
Always great to have a combo.
That was a brilliant introduction. That was quite astonishing.
Yeah, can you live up to it?
We'll see.
In the intro there, I talked about the law of thermodynamics and said that you've come up with something that oppositional to that, which is the first law of flamboyance. Before we go into what that means, I have to put that in context, the geopolitical implications of a Trump victory. I mean, I don't know that there's a more flamboyant leader than Donald Trump.
Well, in a sense, he's the opposite of flamboyant. And the sense is that nations pit themselves against each other. We're very hierarchical animals.
Yeah.
You know how a hierarchy works in a chicken yard. You see peace, nobody's pecking on anybody else except the bottom chicken who gets pecked on occasionally. And the peace is there because the top chicken is utterly in the command and leadership position. She has established that position by taking on every other chicken in the yard at one point or another and demonstrating that she's their superior. That is called a dominance hierarchy, a pecking order. And we humans are really hierarchical animals. So we are constantly struggling for top position or the highest position we can get. And that's not only true of individual humans competing against each other, it's true of groups of humans, And it's true of nations, tribes, and civilizations. And right now, normally, the way a country competes with other countries is by demonstrating it can gather more surplus than anybody else, that it can produce more than anybody else, and it can have the cutting edge technologically over anybody else. Donald Trump, you would think, yes, he's flamboyant, so he's demonstrating surplus. Yes, in a sense, but what he's not demonstrating is he's torn apart the thing that makes a leading country, its alliance, its ability to gather teammates. And he's thrown away the cutting edge. He's throwing away our entire scientific establishment. He's been tearing it to pieces over the last few months, which makes you wonder, is he somehow under the pay of Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping? Because he's doing what it would normally take a war to do. He's taking America to pieces. He's cutting all of its muscles and leaving it helpless on the floor. And he's causing all the other nations to hate us, which leaves a whole world order we constructed since 1945. There's a leadership position in that world order, like the center of a spider's web.
So using that analogy you just talked about, which is the pecking order.
Right.
It's very clear to me, as somebody who studies the psychology of politics, and you, I know you do too, that this is somebody who is very focused on the pecking order. I mean, talks about it as a nation, but it's very much individual. I've just written a piece around charismatic narcissism, and this is very much the behavior of a charismatic narcissist.
Right.
To be at the top of that list. When we look at that, I think where people make the mistake is it's, quote, make America great again, which is the collective, the tribe, as you just talked about. But in fact, in my belief, America can go under the bus as long as the pecking order is held by that person, by that individual. Do you see it that way?
Oh, yes. America is going under the bus.
Right.
The dissolution of America, you could date it to February 27th, which is when Trump and his minions tore Vladimir Zelensky to pieces.
Yep.
That signaled to our European partners that we could not be relied on. It also signaled that to our Asian partners. So our Asian partners are right now scrambling to set up a new alliance structure that doesn't include America. And so are Canada and Europe struggling to set up an alliance that will be independent of America. But as I was saying, this is like we knitted over the course of the last 70 years, something like a spider web. And a spider web has a clear and obvious center, a dominant throne. Donald Trump has slid off of that throne, and Xi Jinping, who has been working on this ever since 2012, has slowly been working his way to take over as what he calls the global hegemon, the key global dictatorial power, what we used to call the leader of the free world. But in Xi Jinping's case, it's the leader of the autocratic world. Donald Trump has this serious man crush on Vladimir Putin.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he's been a bully all of his life, Donald Trump has, and he sees a team of bullies who are bigger than he is. And he wants to be accepted by that team. And the head of that team of bullies, the head of that little club of bullies, is Vladimir Putin. So he will do anything in his power to cozy up to Vladimir Putin. So he is behaving as if he is single-handedly out to give Vladimir Putin exactly what Vladimir Putin has always wanted, which is the destruction of American power.
Let's go into this a little bit differently for a moment, because it would be easy for somebody listening in who is, quote, a Republican, and I don't personally, this is my judgment, and I own that, I don't see Donald Trump as a Republican, so he just happens to be in front of that party. But for somebody who's listening in who is a Republican, let's be clear on Howard Bloom's feelings about Republicans, because I know you have some very powerful Republican friends.
Yes, I try to work in as bipartisan a manner as I can. So I run a number of groups. One of them is called the $2 billion Moon Prize Group, and it includes myself and David Patterson, who are both Democrats, and we're in the minority because it also includes a former three-star general. Former three-star generals are not allowed to announce a political affiliation, but he has always leaned Republican. It includes the former head of the House Science Committee, who wrote the Republican platform plank on space that Donald Trump ran on in the latest election. His partner is a guy who once threw his weight into this group and helped us out, and it's Newt Gingrich. So I very successfully work with Republicans by forgetting about the areas in which we disagree and concentrating on the goals that we have in common. So nonetheless, and I agree with you totally, I think you're absolutely right. There is no more Republican Party of the kind that you and I have known. There is simply a Trump cult.
Yes. I call them Trumplicans as opposed to Republicans because it's a different thing. And it's fascinating to me. And you and I can have this political conversation and make the whole show about that. That's not where we're going to go because we want to talk about your book and about what it is you're doing. But there is a piece in here that ties to it, and that is Elon Musk. Now, Elon Musk, for me, I mean, let's remember he was the darling of the left when he did the electric car thing. And I've written much about this, that I don't think he's a Nazi. That's my opinion. I think he's a very brilliant, very wounded little boy. But he's a very brilliant man who was able to build rockets that could come back, who right. gave away all the patents for the electric cars and has changed the world because of it, which is amazing things. Let's talk about him and the space travel and where you see how that ties into how things are changing.
Well, once upon a time, this was a poison pill of stone. That's mm-hmm. 4.5 billion years ago when it first formed. It went through violent climate catastrophe. Every 6 hours, or every 3 hours, actually, the temperature shot down 88 degrees, and you were bathed in something for 3 hours, absolutely inimical to life, darkness. And then the temperature shot up 88 degrees, and you were bathed in something equally poisonous to life, light, especially ultraviolet light.
So this is living on planet Earth when?
This is living on planet Earth at the very beginning.
Right.
When planetesimals, asteroids, were still smashing into this planet. Why? Because planets are big gravity balls. Gravity balls compete. And the way they compete is when they are bigger than somebody else, they swallow their smaller competitor.
So they're bullies.
Yeah. So we were still swallowing gravity balls. But every time one of these asteroids, a gravity ball, smacked into the planet's face, it was like smacking a pudding with the back of a spoon, and the whole thing shuddered. And yet life, after only a half a billion years of this punishment from the planet of climate catastrophe, life managed to pull itself together in spite of the ongoing catastrophes. And life has continued to pull itself more and more and more and more together in the 3.85 billion years since then. Life has defied little things like the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics says all things fall apart, all things tend toward uselessness. Well, that's not the way this universe works, not at all. Look at life climbing out of this primal pit of climate disaster and climbing step by step by step from bacterial life to multicellular life, life just in the sea. Imagine, Dove, that you had been one of those spunky bacteria that decided to break the laws of nature utterly, because life always breaks the laws of nature, and to rise up and go to this 30% of the earth that was more inhospitable to life than anything you can imagine. It was raw stone. There was nothing to eat up there. There was no place to hide from the sun up there, no place to nest. It was riddled with ultraviolet rays constantly. And if I had been your dad, and you had been insisting on trying out this new huge space of stone that we today call land, I would have said, look, Dove, you're crazy. Life was born in the sea. Life is what nurtures the sea. Life is what gives us a home in the sea. Leave the sea and you are dead. How do we know that? Because you carry a miniature of the sea within your cells. That's how dependent you are on the seas. And Dove, I would have been absolutely wrong. Because some of you crazy nutcase bacteria managed to make it to the land. Now, bacteria don't do anything in isolation. They work in massive teams, groups of billions. And those groups of billions eventually led to land plants, to animals, to you and me. And now 70% of the life on Earth is not in the sea. It's on the land. So this shows you that basically nature loves those who oppose her most.
So we have this idea, again, second law of thermodynamics, that life is moving towards nothingness, to being useless. But your argument is that can't be true, or else we wouldn't be here. So the evolution itself, for you, is a contradiction of that law.
Evolution is a constant rebellion. Evolution is a constant fuck you to nature. And very often it's a fuck you to nature's most fundamental law, gravity. What did you do when you crawled out of the sea and when you began to build up your kin, your clans, your colonies on land? You gave a fuck you to gravity.
Right.
What did you do when you evolved into the first land creatures, bryophytes, that's moss? Well, moss, you dared to climb 2 inches toward the sky. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but compared to one cell, 2 inches is the equivalent of going into orbit.
Yeah, just so you understand, as you listen to that, when you think about moss, you might have seen moss in your garden. It's a single cell organism. It doesn't have a digestive system. It's a single cell that multiplies.
Well, bryophytes actually are multicellular organisms, so there must be different forms of moss.
Yeah, but the first base of moss is single cell moss. And so, you know, that 2 inches is, like you said,
that's almost infinity. That's going to outer space. And then what happens? You land plants get cheeky and you invent lignin and cellulose, and you use lignin and cellulose to create branches. And with branches, you can lift 2 feet into the sky, which is another giant fuck you to gravity. And then come the real rebels, the real opposers of nature. And those take the lignin and cellulose and build them up into big, round things that are vertical that take them way up into the sky, way, way, way up into the sky, so they can grab the light before their competitors at 2 feet high can get anywhere near that light. And this is one of the biggest fuck yous to nature and to gravity that anyone has ever seen. And these audacious creatures who should be punished for their pride, for their hubris, are called trees. And trees defy nature in every conceivable way. They pump something like 20,000 gallons of water up 70 feet high every day. Collectively, all the trees on the planet lift something that's like double the Pacific Ocean up to the skies every day. And trees create 200,000 leaves per tree and then are consumerist and wasteful. What do I mean? At the end of a summer, they discard all those leaves. They just throw them away. There are 4 sins cited in the case of the sexual cosmos. Everything you know about nature is wrong. And they are materialism, consumerism, waste, and vain display. Nature breaks every one of those rules. Nature commits every single one of those sins because nature is flamboyant. What is a tree? It is flamboyant in reaching 70 feet high. It is flamboyant in daring to carry all that water from beneath the earth to its very top. And it is flamboyant in its excess of leaves. It's also flamboyant in its sexuality, but that's another subject.
So what does that say about Elon Musk's desire to move and populate Mars?
Elon Musk is following a natural imperative. Elon Musk is following the same imperative that you followed when you crawled onto the land and that trees followed when they said, screw you to all the land plants, I'm going to outcompete you. You will find that very imperative in nature because another great space program took place 350 million years ago when these creepy crawling little animals decided to try the ultimate experiment and you go to the skies. Now, again, Dove, if I were your parent and you were proposing this thing, I would have said, Dove, listen up. There's nothing for you in the sky. There's nothing. There's nothing to eat up there. There's no place to nest up there. The earth is your mother. The earth is where you belong. The earth nurtures you. The earth feeds you. The earth gives you places to shelter at night. Don't you dare go up there. You know what happens when something up there falls down to earth? It loses its flying ability. It dies. Is that what you want, Dove? And sure enough, many of these insects tried the experiment of flight, saying fuck you to nature's most basic law, gravity, and they took to the skies. And then, roughly 120 million years ago, creatures that were utterly wedded to the land, they walked around on 4 legs, for God's sakes, and some of them decided to try a space program and fly. Well, most of the creatures around, like if I were your father, I would be a conservative dinosaur. And I would say to you the same thing I would have said if I were your parent as an insect. Don't you dare. That's against nature. Nature is telling you in every conceivable way she will kill you if you try to go up there. There is no life for you up there. Well, this morning, when you walked out of your house, how many of the conservative dinosaurs who were earth-loving and stuck to their earthly ways did you see?
So many.
Yes, not so many. And how many of the loony dinosaurs who flew did you see?
Lots, actually.
Yes, lots, because they're birds. So nature is about rebellion against nature.
So let's take that to the next level here, because, again, it would have been easy for somebody who started off in the show thinking, oh, yeah, you're anti-Republican. And as I said, that's not true. You work with both sides of the table, and you and I both have friends who are very strong Republicans. And now we're talking about Elon Musk pushing in a direction that is by our very nature to explore and go beyond. And at the same time, that would say, well, if you are the guy who is against Republicans, then you must be very pro-environmentalist and you must be very much one of those guys. But you have a different slant on environmentalism than most people who are on the left would have had. Talk to us about that, particularly in the context of what you just spoke about.
Well, remember, this is a planet of climate catastrophe, and it will be a good thing if we can decrease the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and stabilize the climate the way it was in 1650 before the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
Or for some, it's 1850. One way or the other, that's going to be a human choice.
Yes.
To do that for our convenience. And guess what? This birth and life itself is made of these choices. They're not anthropogenic in most cases, but insects, birds, and all the rest have worked on their own kind of climate change. A rainforest stabilizes its own climate. It creates its own climate. It creates clouds above it and constant rain. And that's why it's called a rainforest. And the rainforest has the audacity to carve that as if it were sculpture out of the very fabric of the climate. So our goal has to be to develop climate stabilization techniques. Why? Because if we manage to stabilize the carbon dioxide rate, or even to bring it down, the next great climate catastrophe is waiting right around the corner. This is an Earth of ice ages and greenhouse gas effects. And the greenhouse gas effects that are taking place, promoted by nature herself, have sometimes had 1,000 times the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as we have today. 155 million years ago, there were tropical animals and plants at the South Pole.
Yes.
Because those poles were totally open land and they were warm, tropical places. So it's nature itself that we have to contend with. Well, guess what? Nature loves those who oppose her most. So we need to find ways to stabilize the climate. And I have proposed one climate stabilization technology, and it depends on people like Elon Musk. And it's putting up giant solar farms, 5 miles by 5 miles, in space that can suck up solar energy and transmit it to Earth using microwaves, which are harmless because you and I are using them right now. We use them in our cell phones and thus free ourselves of fossil fuels forever. It's a net zero solution. The only thing it won't get rid of is cow farts.
But you argue that the current approach to environmentalism is actually killing our dreams and poisoning our possibilities.
Absolutely. Look at Greta Thunberg. She is the most quintessential downer. So she gives you the sense that humanity is destroying the planet. And this is a standard line on both the mainstream eco group and in the extremist eco groups. Man is destroying the planet. We are a cancer on the planet. And the implication is the ultimate way to stabilize the planet is to get rid of human beings. Well, guess what? This has been a planet of climate disaster and catastrophe for 4.5 billion years. You're not going to get rid of climate change by getting rid of human beings. Climate change is the mainstay of this planet. And you've misunderstood the planet. The planet has been growing life step after step after step. Humans have increased something astonishing on this planet. We have increased sentience.
Mm-hmm.
We have increased it enormously. We've gone from 1 billion people in approximately 1800 to 8 billion people today. Plus, most of those people, probably 70 to 80% of the people on the planet, now have these things, smartphones. And the result is these are vastly augmented human beings. These are not the same kind of human beings that we had in 1850 or in Plato's day, 300, 400 BC. We are radically different. We have been changed by our technology. And because we are constantly upgrading those technologies, we are constantly upgrading, guess what? The power of the cosmos. Because the cosmos uses Earth and any other planets that may be like it, if there are any. We have no evidence that there are any. but it uses us to expand her powers. The universe had a certain envelope of possibilities in 1850. That envelope has been punched open dramatically since 1850 by the invention of the typewriter in 1876, the telephone in 1876, the file cabinet. So you had central data access in 1880, and not to mention the smartphone and now artificial intelligence. And I don't know about you, but I use artificial intelligence every day. It is so valuable that it defies belief. So the people you and I are today are not at all the people our parents would have expected when we were 4 years old, because we live in a universe that has developed new capabilities. Those are new capabilities this cosmos has never seen before, and the cosmos is all about punching open the envelope of possibility, constantly expanding it. We are doing that job on her behalf.
So obviously the planet has changed. It's going to keep changing. We are part of that. Like you said, there are solutions, but we're definitely having an impact. And I'm really interested because you and I are not in our 20s or our 30s. And maybe you remember this. I know I do. I remember being told in my early teens there was going to be another ice age. Then I heard about acid rain. Then there was a hole in the ozone. We're all going to get fried.
Right.
Then it was the climate change and things are going to get hotter and hotter and everything's going to dry. There is all these new disasters every 10 years, it seems. And it seems like now, once you're in your later years, it seems like there's a new disaster coming up. How is it possible to take any of it serious when the, quote, science is changing all the time? And science should change, science should evolve, but it's not only changing, it's contradicting itself, and people lose faith.
Right. And they have good reason to lose faith. The brilliance of the environmental movement, which began with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in 1951, is that the environmental movement tells us we are the sinners. We are the ones who are causing all kinds of catastrophes. And we are the ones who will possibly end things for humanity and for all the plants and animals that we know somewhere in the not too distant future. And because we are the ones causing all of this, by giving up our sins against the planet, we can change this. Well, that's a religious idea that we are responsible, and by sacrificing, we can get the gods to work in our favor. We can get nature to work in our favor. And it really cloaks a desire of humans, a deep need of humans, to have a sense of control over their world. And it gives us a new way of controlling our world, get rid of us. But it's not a very cheerful way, and it doesn't comport with nature and with evolution at all, because evolution is constantly generating new things that produce shocking new properties.
Yes.
The cosmos has been doing that since it first leapt from nothing in the Big Bang, and since time, space, and speed, which is all there was at the beginning of the Big Bang, precipitated like a rain cloud, precipitating in drops, and it precipitated in the very first things, quarks. The existence of time, space, and speed was a radical departure that basically shredded the rules of nothingness. The precipitation of the first quarks was a radical new thing that shredded the whole previous way of being, time, space, and speed. The first atoms were outrageous sins against the previous status quo of the cosmos. But guess what? Nature hates harmony. She uses it all the time, but she loathes an equilibrium. Nature is constantly seeking the next radical revolutionary thing that will upturn everything.
We can go into that a lot more in part two. We're already at the end of part one of the show. Now we get into chaos theory and all those kinds of things. There's a lot more to go in there. And what is our part in this flamboyance if we are to evolve? I want to get into all that too in part two of the show. But before I do, I want to make sure that people know how to find out more about you, Howard, about your new book and the 10 million other books you wrote and your specialties. Please tell people where they can find out more about you.
Well, howardbloom.net, and Howard Bloom, it's all one word, and the Bloom is B-L-O-O-M, like the flowers that bloom in the spring, howardbloom.institute.
Okay, we'll make sure that both of those are posted in the show notes, and of course, any of the social notes that we have, any of the social links will go in there too. The resources that Howard has are vast. The amount of books and all kinds of other resources are there for you to tap into, and I highly recommend that you do. We're going to be back in just one click for more of this delicious conversation with the, what's the right word?
I'm an omnologist. In other words, omnology is a discipline for the promiscuously curious who defy the silos of specialization, soar over the face of the specializations, and see the big picture that emerges when each of those silos becomes a pixel in a landscape.
Well, I'll go with that. We're going to be back in just one click. Stay curious, my friends. Stay curious. Welcome back to part two of our delicious conversation with a MacArthur-level thinker who spent decades tearing apart dogma in science, culture, and politics, to Howard Bloom. His new book is The Case of the Sexual Cosmos. Part one, if you didn't catch it, go back. Do not want to miss it. Howard brings up some very wild and wonderful insights into all kinds of things around how we have evolved and how nature doesn't like harmony. And even suggest that Greta Thunberg might be a bit of a down. More on that if you click back. All right, we're going to dive back in here. Howard, I want to talk to you about something that I think is really quite interesting as a subject. You've talked about in part one and certainly in the book, if the universe favors flamboyant creation over sort of decay, because you're talking about this change in laws, what does that say about depression and apathy? Because humans have that. We get depressed. You know that. I know that. We both experienced it. What does that say about humans when we're going into depression? Are these signs that we've stopped evolving in our creativity?
We humans live in groups. Bacteria live in groups of 2 billion, 7 billion. We live in smaller groups than that. And we act as if we were neurons in a collective brain.
Mm-hmm.
And a neuron, if it senses that it's not needed, it may kill itself off.
Yes.
Why? Because some neurons have got a handle on what's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
And those neurons get additional resources. But some just can't get a clue. And so they either follow along with the leading neurons, or they may commit cell suicide, pre-programmed cell death. Now, that helps the collective intelligence, the group IQ, by focusing resources on the things that are managing to handle the environmental problem of the moment, not on those that just haven't got a handle on things at all. But that's not to your advantage or mine. And we are built in my first book, The Lucifer Principle, and my second book, Global Brain. I point out that we humans are built with self-destruct mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
We are built with depression. We are built with that kind of blank you go into when you're up against a math exam that you've been studying for 4 weeks, and all of a sudden you can't think of a thing. Those are built into us. Why? To disable us when we are not contributing to solutions to the problem of the moment, and to turn us into followers of those who do have a handle. And that is the basic underlying mechanism, not just of brain development, but they are the basic underlying mechanism of collective intelligence, group intelligence.
But when you talk about have a handle on it, that opens up a whole other realm of conversation, because handle on it means understanding it. It could also mean pretending to have a handle on it and being verbose, being, quote, flamboyant, being dominant.
Hyper-confident.
Hyper-confident, narcissistic, et cetera, et cetera. And not really having a handle on it at all, but all of those who feel like they don't will go along. This is groupthink, this is cult mentality, et cetera.
Absolutely true. And we have an example of that beyond any I know of in history in Donald Trump today, who doesn't realize that he's destroying America's position in the world and that he's destroying the American economy. He doesn't even know that tariffs are sales taxes that you and I pay. And yet he has hyperconfidence. He is, in certain senses, a sick man. He lacks a conscience, totally lacks it, like children who might be born with no fingers on one hand. He just doesn't have a conscience. So he projects this super confidence, this massive alpha male confidence. And so people follow that. People need that. People need to follow someone who seems to be on top of things. So Donald Trump is missing his apoptotic mechanisms. He's missing his self-destruct mechanism. He doesn't have depression and the things that you and I would have if we realized we didn't have a handle on things. And he is the most ignorant person in public affairs that at least I have ever seen in my lifetime. So he has no way of knowing the consequences of what he's doing.
But the other side of that is, as we said, these people are following that with the belief system. You know, I mean, I've talked to many people about this, and I talked about the neuroscience of it as well. There are many people who you and I would probably know in common who are very intelligent people who genuinely see this leader as a good leader. And I'm like, I know you're smart, So I don't know how you got to that, really. And I'm not saying that what his rhetoric was bad, because some of his rhetoric was very good. It just was no ability to fulfill that rhetoric. And it's counter to actually what's going on. So that for me is very interesting from a science and neuroscience and psychology, is an intelligent person would seem to have a clue who abandons that clue in favor of the dominant, which is nonsense.
Right. Well, the trick with Donald Trump is that he has alpha signaling, and he has it beyond belief, and he's mastered it in the current era. He started to publicize himself in 1978. By the 1990s, he had made himself such a superstar that in one of my books, How I Accidentally Started the 60s, I used a Donald Trump joke. That's how well-known Donald Trump was when I wrote that book from 1990 to 1995.
Right.
And it's been a long time since then. He's had 35 years since then to build even further. And of course, he had The Apprentice. And you know the story of The Apprentice. When they couldn't find any other hook for him, they knew, the producers of that show knew that Donald Trump would be a good reality show material because he was so well-known. So it couldn't miss, but they couldn't find a hook. And finally, they found this hook of presenting Donald Trump as the ultimate leader, the ultimate leader, above any other leader on the earth. And they shot him apparently 55 stories high in Trump Tower. So he was always looking out in a commanding position over the city. And even though he's a business incompetent, he's had 6 bankruptcies so far, and his 7th will be the bankruptcy of the United States. Despite all of that, they built him for 15 years as the world's ultimate leader. And that's what people believe in. And my Republican friends are Republicans, so they're willing to go along with this. And one of them is Newt Gingrich. And Newt Gingrich is a huge Trump promoter and Trump booster.
But Newt Gingrich, just because I know you have a relationship, you know him, it's easy to look at him and go, he's an idiot because he's following an idiot. And you know, because you and I have talked about it before, Newt Gingrich is a very bright man.
Very.
So that's the piece I'm looking for your insight on for our audience, is here's a very bright man who I disagree with on a million things, Newt Gingrich, but I do know he's an intelligent human being.
Right.
Going along with somebody who doesn't know shit about the subject and backing him all the way. That's the piece that for me is really interesting from a psychology point of view.
Well, there is another aspect to Donald Trump. Donald Trump doesn't know how to implement things, how to make things happen. So groups, if a group can come along who can promise to make things happen, he will affiliate with that group.
Of course.
He affiliated with a group led by a guy named Leonard Leo in his first term, who had been working with Mitch McConnell on setting things up so that the Republicans could take over the Supreme Court. And he made a deal basically with Leonard Leo's group that if they gave him a list of judges, those were the judges that he would nominate. This time, there's a group that has been working for the last 3 years to put together a detailed plan for how to strip the government down to bare bones.
Project 2025, the Christian Nationalist?
Yes. And so they came to him with a plan so ready-made that they had created a LinkedIn-style database of 20,000 people. Those were the cream. They put out calls for people who believed in MAGA, and they got God knows how many responses, and they interviewed every single one of them to find out which ones were competent and which ones weren't. And the competent ones, they put in a 20,000-person database. Then they had a paint-by-numbers plan of how to strip the government down to nothing, and each person had a role, and they trained that person in the role he would play in the government designed to get rid of the government. And Trump signed on to that plan because it was a plan that advanced his vision, which is making himself like Vladimir Putin, making himself a dictator for life, like his friends Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin and Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey. So they had this worked out in detail, and look what they've done. Thanks to Elon Musk. Now, I know Elon Musk. I have followed Elon Musk for 20 years now. Elon Musk is an idealist, and I don't know how he got suckered into this, but one day, one of my Republican-leaning friends in the military, who I would have expected to be cheering for everything that Donald Trump is doing, called me, and his emotional tone on the phone was something I'd never heard from him before. And he said, "Are we still going to have a republic?" Meaning he couldn't stand what Donald Trump was doing. And he proposed an idea I had never heard of, nerd sniping. Well, us nerds have a peculiar quality. If you set us a challenge and we accept it, we will shut down all the rest of our life and just focus on the challenge. And we will work 30 hours at a time and fall asleep under our desk and get up and work on it more. So the person who apparently gave a compelling challenge to Elon Musk is Donald Trump.
Yes.
And Elon worked his tail off. He worked night and day the way he usually works. So he worked on effectuating the plan, on making real the plan that Project 2025 had been working on for 3 years, all in the name of Donald Trump, because it helps Trump in his dictatorial desires.
As I said, I've written a whole article on what drove Elon Musk to that. And I think there's a lot more to that than...
Well, tell me what you think drove him to that.
I mean, from a psychology point of view, Elon Musk is an abused boy. His father was a horrible human being, still is apparently by all accounts, was a pretty horrible human being. Elon was severely bullied in school, obviously quite brilliant and on the spectrum. And then on top of that, this is the guy who's producing kids to try and make up for the population. So this is a person who needs adoration. He needs love. He's not the same level of egomaniacal behavior as Trump, but is more emotionally wounded. But his wound and Trump's wound is their common bond in that they had fathers who were horrendous human beings who treated them very poorly and who beat the emotion out of them. And so there was a great match there. And so what happens is Trump gives Elon the emotional support of an older man that he needed from his dad. And that need, that hunger is so deep that Elon will go to the nth degree in order to meet that, because he will get the daddy love that he needs. I'm not saying that's conscious. Please understand that. It's because these things are part of the emotional source code of that individual, but it's what's unconsciously driving him. And so when somebody meets their need, the problem with it is, as I wrote about in the article, that once he meets Trump's need, Trump will stop meeting his, and under the bus he will go.
Right. And I think that's brilliant. I did a YouTube on this subject, and here's how it goes. In 2020, when Joe Biden took over the White House, Elon Musk was a Democrat. Elon Musk had created one of the most amazing pro-environmental things you've ever seen. He didn't create electric cars. Those have been created by General Motors in the 1990s, but nobody knew how to sell them. And Musk, aside from creating an absolutely gorgeous car with astonishing performance capabilities and basically a little bubble of paradise, he managed to sell these things. Despite that, when Joe Biden had an electric vehicle event, he invited Stellantis, Ford, and General Motors, who don't know how to sell electric cars. Who did he not invite? The man who had put the electric car on the map, Elon Musk.
Yeah, that's in the article that I wrote. I said that's where the Democrats shit the bed with Elon, and that's how he went from being left to right, because that little boy needs acknowledgement. And he should have got it, because he made the electric car cool and he gave away the patent to make it so that GM and all the others can do it. That's why I said he's not a Nazi. He's a little boy who needs love. He got blindsided by them. He lost his rag. And Trump said, well, I'll acknowledge you. You're great. So it's like, all right, we're in.
Well, here's the other element of that story, because your story is basically, as I said, brilliant.
Thank you.
America had not had access to the International Space Station, which was built largely with American money, on an American vehicle for 11 years. Thanks to an aspect of the SMIC, the Space Military Industrial Complex, we could spend an entire other show going into. And after this 11 years of barrenness, buying tickets at $75 million to space from the Russians, how embarrassing, how humiliating can you get? One man created a vehicle that could finally get reliably back and forth to the International Space Station and took humans up, Americans, for the first time on an American vehicle in 11 years. That deserved a phone call from the president.
Absolutely.
That phone call never came. So Biden snubbed Elon Musk because Biden is very pro-union, and a man like Elon, who's creating a whole new way of making a company succeed, has created whole new ways for employees to work. And if he'd had a union, he could not have done that. So it was the snubs from Biden that eventually drove Musk into the hands of Donald Trump. But the first time I saw Elon Musk, he said, When I got out of college, I asked myself, what three things would do the most to change humanity in my lifetime? And my answers were the internet, alternative energy, and space. And so he said, I went into the internet, and of course he helped build PayPal and got close to $1 billion from that. Then he took that $1 billion, skipped number two, skipped alternative energy, and went to space. And when I saw him in 2005, he had not even put a firecracker in a tin can. He had launched nothing. And the space military industrial complex companies were laughing at him.
And they actively humiliated him. His own heroes humiliated.
So what did he do? As of last week, he has launched 450 Falcon 9 missions to space. No country, no organization, nothing has ever come anywhere near doing that. NASA instead has a rocket that costs $2 billion to launch, $4 billion, sorry, the figure has changed, and you can only launch it once every 2 years. $4 billion, I mean, you can buy 50 or 60 of Elon Musk's flights for that cost.
Yes.
You can have a whole space program for that cost. So right now, changes at NASA are necessary because this program called the Space Launch System, it's known in the business, because I run three space groups, it's known as a senatorial launch system because it basically was cobbled together by Congress and the Senate.
Right.
And then rammed down NASA's throat. And things don't work when you work that way. That's a Stalinist way of running a space program. Elon has provided a whole different alternative. And back to the story of the loony insects who flew and the insane dinosaurs who dared to fly, Elon is taking us on that next step. His company now, SpaceX, is a regular space transport company. We've never had anything like it in human history. And that is what is going to take ecosystems to space. That's what's going to allow us to green the solar system and garden the universe.
So honestly, based on that, do you see that we will colonize Mars? And if so, when do you think that will be?
Well, let's see. We'll probably get the first humans to Mars by something like 2035 or earlier, because Elon is aiming at far earlier. He's aiming at this by 2028 or 2027. And if he can only get his Starship to stop blowing up, then we will make it, because the Starship will carry 100 passengers instead of the traditional NASA 3 or 4 passengers. This is a vast difference in scale, and it'll carry tons and tons and tons, 100,000 tons or something like that of cargo.
Yeah.
And again, after I saw Elon speak, you know, I have this thing in my gut, and it's only gone off about 6 times in my life, and it's a super SIR detector. And it's how I detected Prince and how I detected Joan Jett and how I detected Chaka Khan. That little thing in my gut went off and said, this person is a superstar, long before they were known to the public.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was the one who helped get them known by the public.
Yep.
And when I first saw Elon speak, that detector went off, except it said, Bloom, you've been looking for a myth all your life. This is not just a superstar. This is a mythic person. Kids will be following his example 115 years from now. And my God was extremely specific about that date, 115 years from now. So I had 3 phone conversations with Elon. I hadn't processed verbally why I was talking to him. So I couldn't tell him why I was talking to him. And they were useless. And he said on the third call, well, look, you know, we're not really doing anything on these calls. And I have a lot of other things to do. So I know that Elon is at his core an idealist, or he would never have asked what three things will do the most to change humanity in my lifetime. He is focused on Mars. He wants to die in a city on Mars. And one thing about Elon Musk that makes him different from anybody else on the planet is that when he wants to achieve something really badly, he can achieve it.
Yeah.
So it'll be later than Elon is predicting, though he hasn't given us a prediction on exactly when that will happen, because it'll take him more time. As long as he stays alive and healthy, he will get humanity and life to Mars. And there's an old Bloomism, bring space to life by bringing life to space. That is exactly what Elon is in the business of doing.
He's an interesting character because I think there's more complexity to him. For me, Trump is a very simple examination psychologically. Elon has a great deal more depth because he runs very dark and very light.
There's one other thing to be very aware of A civilization only goes as far as its visionaries will take it.
That's true.
Visionaries who are capable of implementing their visions.
That's very true.
And those
true.
Are very few.
Yes.
You have maybe three of them in 100 years. And Elon is the greatest one that I have ever met.
Let's just change directions for a minute. You, in your book, talk about replacing the second law of thermodynamics with the first law of flamboyance.
Right.
If you could rewrite one more law of nature from scratch, what would it be? And what would you call it?
Well, it's not so much a law as this universe is incredibly creative. It is constantly coming up with things that never existed. When the first atoms came along, nothing like them had ever existed before. When the first sweepings of atoms into giant swirling pools of matter happened, those had never existed before. When those started firing off stars, stars had never existed before. I don't want a law. I want to understand how that creative process happens and why. And I've spent several books on trying to crack the code. And I think the things that I say are, I hope, radically new and will open your eyes to the cosmos in which you live in very different ways from the past. But I haven't cracked that code. And I'm about to be 82 years old. The amount of time left to me to crack it is limited. I would just want a giant nutcracker with which to crack that code.
You talk about sex as nature's metaphor for innovation. From that point of view, what's the biggest romantic failure of modern science in an era that desperately needs to start mixing things up?
It is a mistake that Charles Darwin led us to.
Mm.
Charles Darwin came up with what was called a mechanism, something we can discuss for hours, but a mechanism for evolution.
Right.
And that mechanism was natural selection. And Darwin knew that that was maybe 10% of what evolution was all about, that he was missing the other 90%. Because the other 90% is how evolution creates new varieties, new species, new inventions, radically new inventions. Science grabbed onto natural selection, forgot about the importance of the puzzle, the mystery of creativity, cosmic creativity, and has run with natural selection as if you can use natural selection to understand the whole ball of wax. Well, even Darwin knew that that was only 10% of the ball of wax. It's the creative 90%. That we don't understand. And I've tried to give you a little inkling of what that creative thing is and how it works in the case of the sexual cosmos, whose subtitle is Everything You Know About Nature Is Wrong.
You know, it's also interesting, though, is how even Darwin's theory of evolution is so often misquoted. It's survival of the fittest and the strongest. No, it's the survival of those who can work together. It's a bit more than that. To become strong, yes, but it's not just that. And there's more in there than that, right? You go into that quite in detail.
Right. I tell you that groups have an identity. We know that when we call ourselves Americans, when we call Vladimir Putin's country Russia, when we talk about China, we're talking about group identities.
Mm-hmm.
And those group identities are extremely real. And they're at a level of reality that science doesn't see. These are called emergent properties in science. For example, water, when it's flowing, flow is an emergent property.
Yes.
Of lots and lots of billions of, well, gazillions of water molecules. But take the temperature down below 32 degrees, and what do you get? All of a sudden, the water's social behavior changes, and it socializes in a whole new way. And that new way is a solid form called ice. Ice is an emergent property. It's a group property. It's a social property. And we haven't sufficiently studied the ghost that arises from a group, that higher identity that arises from a group and makes it China or Russia or the New York Mets or any of these group identities we deal with constantly but don't see in science.
Well, what I put that into, from my point of view, what I put that into is there becomes an emotional source code, a collective that is a morphic field around that tribe. So it's like, this is true because I'm an American. No, this is true because you tap into a morphic field where you hold that belief collectively, and that's what you're actually trying to pull out of the gravity of. And that's where the challenge becomes, is can we innovate and pull out? Because it's very difficult to innovate in the confines of the field.
Right. Well, I have a friend who is a cognitive scientist who plays jazz, and his quartet gets together and they play together. And he shows a remarkable property that is the morphic field you're talking about. They get to a certain point in their playing where a melody arises from the collective, and they hear a melody that, technically speaking, isn't there.
Right.
And they all play to that melody. And what is that emergent melody? It's the morphic field that takes over and fashions the group.
The thing that evolves from the thing.
Right. So that's missing from science. Emergent properties, morphic fields, you could call them, except that gets too close to Rupert Sheldrake and his ideas. Those are too controversial for me to deal with because they don't resonate with my soul.
I think that morphic fields are very interesting, particularly even brain science. There's a lot of really great research around how it impacts neurons in the brain and all the rest of it. But it's not quite in the same framework as Sheldrake, because Sheldrake's stuff is, in my opinion, brilliant, but as you said, quite controversial. But there's an evolution of it, as there is to all things. And that's, how can we think about this in a bigger way and in a more evolved way? And that's what you're saying about this emergent state that comes from. And that's the way I always describe that, is the two things that come together don't create a combination of the thing. They create a third thing. My children are not just an expansion of me and my bride. There's something else altogether. There's properties of me and properties of my partner, but there's something else altogether, something unique that can transform the world. Elon Musk's mother and father created Elon Musk, but Elon Musk is not them.
And that's a major point that's made in the case of the sexual cosmos, that we're not in the reproduction business. You're not making little dove barons.
Thank God for that.
Yeah, and sex. This is where sex comes in. There is a law in science. It's the law of least effort. Pierre de Maupertuis enunciated it in 1750, and it's held true in science ever since, that nature always takes the shortest path. Well, sex is the longest path you've ever seen in your life. And I'm not just talking about courtship, finding a mate and finding the right one. I'm talking about the molecular processes that go on in sexuality, in sexual recombination, are just astonishing beyond belief. And they're so complicated that a Mensa graduate can't even remember all the details. I spent at least a year and a half just studying that molecular process of sex, and even I can't remember it. Sex is not the shortest path. It is the very longest path that this cosmos has ever invented. And why have, for a billion years now, has nature insisted on sex? Because when you and your mate get together and you create a child, that child is a one of a kind. There has never been a child like that on the planet. There may never be another child like that on the planet. So what is the purpose of that? The purpose is simple. The cosmos is a search engine, constantly sending out feelers and sensors to sense its way, to feel its way into the next realm of impossibility.
Yes.
And to drag that impossibility into the realm of reality. And the more feelers the cosmos can produce, feeling its way into impossibility space, and hopefully yanking a little of that impossibility back into the realm of the real, the more feelers, the better.
I love that line, Howard. The dragging the impossible into the realm of reality. I just love that. That's beautiful. And it's a great place for us to finish. Please tell everybody where they can find out more about you, about the new book, and about all the other things that you've got there.
So go to howardbloom.net. That's B-L-O-O-M, like the flowers that bloom in the spring, howardbloom.net. Or Howard Bloom, again, B-L-O-O-M, howardbloom.institute.
We'll make sure that those are posted in the show notes. Again, Howard, it's been a pleasure and an honor, sir. It's always a pleasure and honor. I hope you'll stay with us to the end. I just love our conversations. We always have so much fun going to these wild and wacky areas, even when we're not recording.
Right.
For you, dear listener, remember, those who control the meaning for the tribe also control the movement of the tribe. Leaders who are committed to positively shaping the political and business landscape know that we must tap into what drives human behavior. And that is the emotional source code. I'm Dov Barron. I show businesses, teams, and leaders how to harness their emotional source code to move their tribe. Because unified, actualized meaning is the single monolithic difference between mediocrity and greatness for all individuals and companies. And remember, we need your help to stay relevant, so please go to wherever it is that you tune into from, and do us a favor, rate, review, and subscribe to the show. And a big thank you to you, if you are a regular listener, for sharing the show with everybody you know. Till next time, Stay curious, my friends. Stay curious about what you're holding as true, and maybe you need to question it. And maybe there is much more to the chaos than there is to what is plotted out for you. Maybe it's time for us, all of us, to reach into the impossible and drag it back into reality. I'm Dov Barron. I'm here to assist you tapping into your deepest meaning to reach that next level of clarity, focus, purpose, and profit in your business, in your life, and your leadership impact. And I am out.